It's the story of one of Duval's most prominent political leaders. Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect, and I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. And just ahead this morning, it's the story of former Jacksonville Mayor Jake Godbold out in a new book. We'll speak with the author and Jake himself in just a moment. You can join us. It's 549-2937. Give us a call. Then later, new efforts to protect Florida's coastlines from offshore drilling. That and more just ahead. But first this hour, it's a brand new biography telling the tale of one of this city's most colorful and influential leaders. Former Mayor Jake Godbold began his life during the Depression in Jacksonville public housing. He even sold boiled peanuts on the streets as a kid. Godbold used his outsized personality and passion to transform this city, and he has remained a force in the local political landscape for half a century. Right now, we're pleased to welcome author and political strategist Mike Tolbert. He's the author of Jake, and he joins us now in studio. Mike Tolbert, good morning.
Good morning, dear. How are you?
I'm well, and thanks for being on the show.
My pleasure.
And what are your questions about the new book, Jake? Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org and tweets to @MelissaInJax. We're already getting your tweets. We'll go to that in our Facebook comments in a moment. Mike Tolbert, you've known Jake Godbold for many years. This book has been years in the making. You've talked to dozens of people. Tell me a little bit about what went into this book.
Well, it was a two-year labor of love, really, and I spent hours and hours and hours over many days talking to Jake and interviewing him, recording those interviews. And then I probably spoke to another 50 to 60 individuals who know him and have worked with him or been around him, both good and bad. Tons of research. So we feel like we've given birth now, finally, after 2 years.
Sure. And, of course, Mayor Godbold held office as mayor throughout most of the 1980s. Before that, serving on the city council, he was spearheading projects at that time that remain so important today. He created the Jacksonville Jazz Festival. He led efforts to bring the Jaguars to town, among other accomplishments. So there's a lot to get into here.
Well, you know, interestingly enough, Melissa, being around when a lot of that happened, I remembered a lot of things. But in going back and doing the research, it was just overwhelming what he got accomplished during that period of time. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that he was an absolute leader, still is. But secondly, he believed in partnerships. He felt like that I can't do this alone. That's not my job. My job is to bring people to the table who can make things happen and get them involved and get their energy and their insights. And let's work as a team. And that's what he did.
It's 549-2937 to join the show. And in the telling of Jake Godbold's story, you write about the fact that he represented the last of a dying breed in political culture. He was a Southern populist style mayor. Can you explain a little bit more about that?
Well, and Southern populist in this way. Sometimes we think of a Southern populist as being somebody who's all white. Jake was very much not that. Jake was a man of the people, black, white, brown, it doesn't matter. And he went out of his way to try to represent the people. That was the most important thing. It was to have relationships with people from the bottom to the top and represent them and try to speak for them and get them involved.
He has continued to speak out on a number of controversial issues that have dominated the headlines recently, everything from the demolition of the Jacksonville Landing to plans to sell JEA to the push to, we're just learning this week, to have an appointed rather than an elected school board, and paired with that, a proposed half-cent sales tax referendum for Duval County Public Schools. Godbold, Jake, has weighed in on all of this. Not surprising to you?
No, and he'll continue to weigh in, I suspect, until his last breath. It would not surprise me that when he takes his last breath, he's going to be speaking up about something.
What about you? As someone who has worked in media and politics in this community for many years, what are your thoughts about what's happening in Jacksonville right now?
My thoughts aren't really important. But I'm delighted to have a friend and a partner like Jake Godbold, who people listen to and who people respect when he speaks. I'm not the speaker.
You're not. You're trying to tell the story. Certainly, though, you have opinions, Mike.
Oh, I have a lot of opinions, and I can tell you my opinions pretty much mirror what Jake says. You know.
And he's not short on words.
He's never been short on words. I say in the book that the greatest gift he ever had was when he learned to talk.
The gift of gab, as they say in politics. And if you're just tuning in as we talk about the new book, Jake, former Mayor Jake Godbold's story, it's 549-2937. We'll go to your calls in a moment. We have a call right now. It's former Mayor Godbold. Jake, is that you?
Yeah, I'm here.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning. I've been enjoying your program.
Well, thank you, and thanks for joining us now. What's it like to have your story told in a book?
Well, it's very humbling and very exciting. And, I just am absolutely overwhelmed with the whole thing, and I'm just so thankful for the people that helped us do it. You know, it could have never happened without a lot of help, you know, and it was the real thing about this thing was that I had thought that I had called John Coxwell a long time ago, and a lot of people know John, and John had a high school education. That was about it, and he came to be one of the great developers in Jacksonville, and a humbling background from started out with one little tractor, and I called John and asked him to that I would thought it he ought to have his story printed so other young people coming up like him would knew what he accomplished with the good ethics and hard work. And John said, I'll let him write a book about me if you'll write one about you. And I said, John, I can't afford to pay for a book to have like that about me. So John said, that's all right. When he gets through with mine, I'll take care of the rest of it. I'll take care of yours and mine if you'll spend the time with Michael and give him the time that it takes to do this thing. And so that's the way it started off. And then John passed away, and he got the book written. But then we had to have a lot of financial help to get through it. And there is so many, Melissa, so many people. I didn't know how we were going to do it, you know. I didn't have the money to pay for it, but so many people come forward that I couldn't start naming right now, but Padgett, Bill Gay, and just so many, Haskell, and so many people, Holly Smith, and all of them came forward.
Sure, they all came out to support it.
They all came out.
Mayor Godbold, I need to, if I could, there's so many folks waiting on hold to talk to you, but I have a few questions for you, because in recent days, you have weighed in quite vocally about some controversial issues that have dominated headlines and discussion around town. Yes. Everything from the planned demolition of the landing to plans to sell JEA to controversy over how we will pay for school repair and construction and an appointed versus an elected school board. I want to ask you about those three things, if I could, beginning with JEA. You recently wrote in the Florida Times Union that you were disappointed with the mayor over revelations that the utility may now be sold. Why does that concern you?
Well, I don't believe it's necessary. There's challenges to all utilities these years, but we have the wrong person. I think everybody in town knows that the wrong person is over there running JEA, a person that I don't know, and I don't personally say anything, but he's not qualified to take us through this period. And it is a trying period of time, but we need somebody over there. And there were people that put in their application that was very, very, very qualified. This man was not qualified to take us through this period of time. He was put there to do what he's doing, and that is to put JEA for sale. It's not the right thing to do, and I don't want to see the water rights. The water rights are just as important as the electrical end of it. We have problems in South Florida with water. We have problems in Georgia with water. We have the greatest water in a lot of it. The people would love to get a hold of our water rights. I don't believe we had the financial condition. And the board that served there before this board, I've talked to many of them, and they say this board is not financial. I've talked to people in the bond market who say JEA is in better condition than these people are saying that it's in. I think we could go through this period, but we need a different leader over there to take us through it. I think we're getting rid of the goose that lays the golden egg, and it's never going to be the same again.
You've also been critical of the Jacksonville City Council in terms of the reluctance to approve a proposed half-cent sales tax referendum for the Duval County Public Schools. Some of the city council members have said that their feelings were hurt by your words. And so what's been the fallout from that, and where are you on that now?
Well, I wrote that letter to hurt their feelings a little bit because I've talked to many of them prior to that. And their answer to me every time their answer to me prior to when I was them getting elected, many of them I helped to get elected, and it was that they were going to be strong advocates of public education. And then it all went away when they got elected. So somebody's talked to them. Somebody's put pressure on them. And they have not stood up. My feeling about this situation is I think the school board and the school superintendent has done a wonderful job. Maybe there still needs to be some questions answered. But there is no doubt I have visited many, many public schools, and they are in horrible condition. I am concerned of kids being hurt or their life. And this needs to go on the ballot. All I'm saying is if you give me a chance to have my and that is to vote for it or against it. What is wrong with putting it on the ballot and letting the public know, say if they want it?
Jake, I've got to move on and ask you about one more thing because we're running a little tight up against the break.
I
you helped create the Jacksonville Landing when you held office. What do you think of the planned demolition of the landing and also the Lot J development plan around the football stadium?
Well, the Lot J stadium sounds beautiful. I don't know how in the world, as you look at it, they're going to finance the thing. I just don't know. I don't know how that's going to turn out or how you're going to pay all this. There's also a lot of environmental problems down at Lot J that a lot of people don't know about that the city of Con 1 is going to have to clean up. Mark my word, there's some environmental problems in Lot J.
And are you upset at all about the landing being demolished since you brought it to town? How are you accepting of that?
My problem with that is we built the landing for the public. We built the landing to have pride and excitement, and we've had some good times there when Rouse ran the thing. They knew what they were doing. They were the best in the country, and they were the centerpiece. I believe that piece of property belongs to the taxpayers, but the mayor won't discuss with us what plans he has for it. Maybe he has some wonderful plans to do something, but whatever he does, I want it to be something for the public. That land there, we set that aside for the people, for entertainment, for good times, to bring the people together, the center of downtown. Now, but the mayor's never talked to me about it. He's never had a discussion. But the important thing, he's never talked to the public. So we don't really know what he has planned for the future, you know?
All right, let's go to some calls now for former Mayor Jake Godbold and author Mike Tolbert. Mike's new book, Jake, is in stores now. Both Jake and Mike will be at a book signing tomorrow at the Jacksonville Historical Society. But first, let's go to some of your calls. It's 549-2937. Give us a call. Lamar is in Mandarin. Hi, Lamar. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Thank you for your program. I often listen to you on my drive to work in the morning.
Thanks.
Mayor Goldbolt, are you still there?
Yes, I am.
Thank you for your service. I was a big supporter of you during your term in office, and I think you did many wonderful things for the city of Jacksonville. And I'm so proud to hear that you're still involved in matters that will affect our city and make it better. I was thinking back to the term, to the period, mid-80s, whenever you were our mayor. I lived in Mandarin at that time with my wife and three children. And oftentimes when we would come home at night, the stench from air pollutants would gather in the Mandarin area, and our house had a terrible stench to it whenever we walked in. And I remember a time where you were commenting on that air pollutants, and you referred to it as "it smells like money to me." And I was wondering if you had any regrets about making that statement, and can you help me remember what you did to make it better? Thank you. I'll hang up and listen.
All right. Thanks, Lamar.
Well, I'm not the one that made that statement. There was one of our councilmen who has passed away now made that statement, and he said that a lady called him one day, and she hollered, "Do you smell it? Do you smell it?" And it was late at night, and he said, "Lady, what I smell is money and jobs and people working and everything." And that's what he said. But that call was about Glidden's, but I didn't say that. I was very concerned about the odors from the two mills and from Glidden's, and we had negotiated that and worked on it. We were trying to do something that would we didn't want to lose the jobs, we didn't want to lose the people's income, we didn't want to lose the industries, but we were working very hard with them to sign off on a timetable thing to eventually get it done. But then when Tom Zuri came in and did a good job.
Right, helped get rid of the paper mills, Tommy Azuri. Let me ask you as a follow-up. You mentioned the pollutants that any developer will have to address on Lot J, down under the pavement there, next to TIAA Bankfield. We've heard a fair bit about this already, but could you expand a little bit more on that?
No, I'm not technical enough to expand. I just remember the problems that we had. And I remember at one time when we had a big affair there, and we were trying to put up tents and drive some stakes down in the ground, the environmental people wouldn't even let us do that because some kind of problem in there. There's some engineers and people around that can explain that, but I can't do it. It's too technical.
All right, John is in San Marco. John, good morning.
Good morning, and thank you so much. Melissa, your opening was beautiful. And, sir, thank you for your time. Sir, you were here in the 60s when the Human Rights Ordinance was enhanced and improved, and they moved forward. And then you were here again in 2017 when they added more people, made it more inclusive. In the light of what's going on now, what else do you think Jacksonville could do with their Human Rights Commission to make Jacksonville be known as a welcoming city?
Well, I'm 86 years old. I've never seen a period of time like it is right now. This ought to be one of the most happy periods of my life. And I go to bed praying and thinking, I've just never gone through a period in my life. At 86, I've never gone through a period in my life where there's so much hate and so much diversity, and I'm just tired of it. But I'm just one little person that's beginning to get tired and wore out of these fights. I've had so many battles and so many fights. I don't know how many more I can go through.
Are you saying you're tired of the local political fights or what's happening at the national level?
I'm both.
Both.
And I think, if I can interrupt, he misspoke. He didn't mean it was too much diversity. I think he meant adversity.
Adversity. And here's a tweet from Jason. How many ethics violations has our current mayor broken in the past year? What does Jake think about him ethically? Does he think the mayor is being transparent?
Well, I don't know about ethically, and I don't know anything unethical that the mayor is doing, and I don't think he's an unethical person. I just don't like the policies, and I don't like the way I think he could be a better mayor by communicating more with the media, through the media, to the public. It seems like that the media and him doesn't get along too well, and I don't know. He just doesn't. I would be more communicative, and I think he could use the media to get his word out of where he's going and what he's doing and what he's thinking. If he would use them more, and I think they would be more receptive to him.
Well, he has done interviews mainly on local television. We certainly have an open invitation for him to appear on this show. But let me ask you, Mayor Godbold, politics has changed a lot since you were the mayor. What do you think has been the biggest change here locally in terms of how the city is run and how the political leadership operates?
I don't know if I could tell you that. I just think that I just don't agree with some of the policies. I don't agree. It seems like we're trying to put the power of the mayor too much, I believe in a public school. I believe in the public having the right to vote for the tax. I believe that the public ought to have a right to have an elected school board term. I don't want to give up anybody that's elected.
You think about this new proposal? State Representative Jason Fisher has put this before the Duval delegation that we would have an appointed rather than an elected school board.
I'm against it, absolutely. The charter wrote that we should have a public school board, and I think we should. And I think the public has a right to vote their school board members in and have a voice in it. This way we'll have one person that'll have the same damn power he's got over there with the JEA when he put his board members there. And then you put it under the school board. I don't know if the next thing you want to do is take over the sheriff and have an appointed sheriff. I believe that we need to have the public more involved in some of this.
Mike Tolbert, a recent editorial in the Times Union, speaking of the media, said that we are witnessing the mass privatization of our civic life in Jacksonville, Florida. What's your response to that?
Well, I think he's go ahead, Jake.
I think he's right. I think that that here, all we have to do is pick up the paper every morning and see we just centralizing everything under one mayor. Curry won't be mayor forever. In 3 years, we'll have another mayor. But I'm just for the public having a say-so and who represents them in the school board. And I don't think everything ought to be. If I was mayor today, I certainly wouldn't be for taking over the school board and appointing them and being responsible for them. The charter did it right. I believe that we had a great charter, and when it was written, and that's the way we put it in. But we're changing a lot of that now, and taking the voice of the public away.
Mike Tolbert.
Hey, Jake, I'm here.
Yeah, Michael.
I love you. Anyhow, no, I think it's pretty obvious. I mean, we're going to privatize the JEA. We're going to privatize more schools, put them in private hands and make them money makers, allegedly, even though they're going out of business left and right.
You mean charter schools?
Charter schools.
I mean, under Florida law, they are public schools.
Public schools, but guess what? Yeah, they're not. If they were public schools, they would be included in the funding, and you wouldn't have to set aside $150 million specifically for charter schools. I mean, that's nonsense.
And, the Florida legislature would have to approve a measure to make Duval County School Board appointed rather than elected. Do you think that could pass the legislature?
Well, given the times that we live in, given the mayor that we have, given the city council we have, given the legislative delegation we have, and given the legislature we have, and given the governor we have, I wouldn't be surprised at all if that doesn't pass.
Do you think that what's happening with education in Duval County is people have called this ground zero for in Florida for the battle for public education in the state? Is that a hyperbole?
I'm not qualified to answer that, Melissa. I'm really not able to answer that.
Melissa, I'd just like to say that I am not against charter schools, but I think they're asking for too much, and I think the superintendent has the right idea to be fair with charter schools and give them their fair share, but they want more than their fair share, and if this thing was put on the ballot right now, it would pass, in my opinion. But they're not giving me a chance to vote. They're not giving the public a chance to say it. I could accept it if the public voted it down. I would accept that. But give the public a chance to say this. But the very guy that was the mayor's campaign manager and pollster, he owns a number of charter schools, and I think what's standing in the way of putting it on the
Who's
ballot.
Who's that? Who are you referring to?
Oh, well, I don't want to get into all that, but...
Okay, well, let me, you know what, speaking of the public, let me get some public commentary on the air. Lots of tweets coming into the show. Here's a tweet from Brian. Thank you, Mayor Godbold, for advocating representative government. Paul emails the show. My favorite Jack's mayor and my favorite campaign slogan he had from his second campaign, everything's Jake in Jacksonville. That must have been you. You must have come up with that, Mike. Let's go to some calls now for Mike Tolbert and Jake Godbold, 549-2937, Bonnie in Jacksonville Beach. Good morning, Bonnie.
Good morning, Melissa. Good morning, Mayor. My question surrounds the crime in Jacksonville. Curry ran on a One Jack's anti-crime platform, yet this year alone we've had 99 deaths from gun violence. They report 79 as murder, the rest remain unclassified. However, he only committed, I believe it was $750,000 to the Cure Violence program, but for the last 2 years the JSO has received a budget increase of $35 million. So we don't really have a prevention strategy, but we seem to have a catch and incarcerate strategy. What would you do differently, sir?
Thanks for your question, Bonnie.
This is a real problem there, and I think the mayor and the sheriff have a good relationship. I think everything that the sheriff has requested, the mayor is giving. I think he's sincerely trying the best he can to work on the crime. It's just a very deep thing that goes. There's just a lot of guns out there, and I know the minority community very well, and they're the ones that take the worst part of the thing out there. They're the ones that can't get out. They're the ones that can't have a party in their yard. It's a very sad thing. I don't really know what the answer to it is. And of course, the gangs, that's all about, most of it is all based around drugs out there and drug wars and everything. It's a difficult, challenging job. And I think the mayor is doing as much as he can, as hard as he can, working with the sheriff to try to solve the problem. It's a big problem, and it's a problem that's going to be have to solve by a lot of people.
And with all of that said, we've touched on a lot of big issues, but let's bring it back to the book, because both Jake and author Mike Tolbert will launch Godbold's biography, Jake, at a special event tomorrow morning at the Jacksonville Historical Society. This kicks off at 10:30 a.m. They're right next to the baseball grounds. You're going to read just a little bit from the book as we go to break, Mike, right?
These are the last two paragraphs in the book. The one thing of which Godbold is most proud has nothing to do with brick and mortar. Instead, it is the burning spirit he ignited in order to change Jacksonville forever. No longer a city that didn't know how to dream, or a place whose own residents didn't like living there. Today, Jacksonville continues to be a dynamic community that believes it belongs on the big stage and is unafraid to set its aspirations high. Like all cities, Jacksonville has its issues related to education, crime, and infrastructure. But more often than not, its leaders tend to work together to find solutions. That notion of partnerships to make things happen and the collective attitude of the little train that could is Jake's legacy.
Well, gentlemen, it's been such a pleasure having you on the show. And this is just a preview of the big event tomorrow. So you can come on out to the book signing and discussion for Jake, the biography of former Mayor Jake Godbold. Meet Jake and author Mike Tolbert, 10:30 a.m. tomorrow at the Jacksonville Historical Society on A. Philip Randolph. Jake, hello, Mike, hello. Thank you so much.
Thank you, dear. It's a very pleasure to be here. It really has. And I'm highly impressed by your listeners.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Jake Godbold. We appreciate you being on the show.
Thank you, Melissa. And I really enjoy your show. I listen to it every day.
Well, thanks. That's great to hear. And up next, protecting Florida's coasts from offshore drilling. New efforts. We'll tell you about them after this.
By the time today's babies are 80 years old, the sea is projected to have risen up to 6.6 feet. So what's being done to protect life on the first coast? On ADAPT from WJCT, you'll find stories about adaptation by everyone from the Navy to realtors and the city of Jacksonville. Join us now at adaptflorida.org.
WJCT's Jaguar Season Parking is still available. Be part of the coolest tailgating downtown. Includes paved space, indoor bathroom access. Contact 358-6327 or log on to wjct.org/parking. Reserve your space today.
I'm David Luckin, host of the Electro Lounge, inviting you to join me Tuesday nights at 9 for Turntable Tuesday, only at the Electro Lounge on 89.9, your community, your world, your music.
Welcome back. A new report is out focusing on coastal conservation here in Florida, and it points up the need to protect this state's coastline and our oceans, too. J.P. Brooker is Senior Manager and Policy Counsel for the Florida Conservation Ocean Conservancy, and he joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning. Great to be here.
Good to have you. You know, you recently testified on Capitol Hill to the House Natural Resources Committee about the need for legislation aimed at improving coastal resiliency here in Florida. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I was invited by the House Natural Resources Committee to come up and speak about Florida-specific issues related to coastal resiliency, whether that means stabilizing shorelines in the face of sea level rise, or if it means protecting heritage communities and, you know, coastal working waterfronts like we see here in the First Coast area, like Mayport, for example. Mm-hmm. So there's a handful of bills that are currently before the House that would work towards protecting these communities and protecting the ecosystems that they rely on.
Let's begin with the first point you touched on, protecting the coast from sea level rise. What's being done about that?
Well, there's a lot that can be done. In the legislation, there are incentive programs that would focus on you know, funding projects that could help restore dune ecosystems, for example, or mangrove ecosystems or seagrass ecosystems that could help rebuild oyster beds. All of these kinds of ecosystems are natural buffers towards
living shorelines.
Correct. Living shorelines that are natural buffers that help increase thriving wildlife and abundant wildlife while also protecting against the rising seas that we're seeing on a daily basis here in Florida.
And let me just make a plug for our digital magazine, adaptflorida.org, which we have published online here at WJCT, looking at these kinds of efforts. And how much more critical do you think this will become for Florida? Living shorelines and other efforts to protect the state. We're so vulnerable, given that we have the most coastline of any state in the union.
No doubt. And I think you're already seeing some of the major financial repercussions in some cities around the state. For example, Miami Beach is slated to spend $400 million by 2030 on infrastructure projects to help protect their city and their coast. So sustainability, aimed at coastal resilience, these living shoreline type projects are included in those types of expenditures. So you're seeing a huge investment in the state's coastlines, and it's necessary if we want to continue to have the cultural identity of the beaches that we've had for so long, as well as the tourist economy that we rely on.
Now, going beyond the shorelines, let's talk about a little bit offshore. Last year, the Trump administration proposed a new 5-year offshore oil and gas plan. It aims to open up most of America's coastline to offshore drilling. Certainly, that has been quite controversial in Florida. Political leaders of both parties have spoken out against it. The plan has been delayed for now. Where does this effort go from here, and how does your organization weigh in on that?
Yeah, Ocean Conservancy is opposed to oil and gas drilling in the Gulf of Mexico and in the South Atlantic off the coast of Florida. We have seen Secretary Bernhardt of the Department of the Interior, Trump's replacement for Secretary Zinke, pump the brakes on oil and gas drilling in these regions. However, we've seen as recently as July 18th a renewed emphasis coming from Secretary Bernhardt in support of oil and gas drilling in these regions. So while there's nothing on the books that will allow for oil and gas drilling right this second, there is this constant threat lingering that we are definitely in opposition to.
And in Florida, politics can make strange bedfellows sometimes. And around this issue, I think more than any other, we've seen near unanimous opposition because our beaches are part of our economy, right?
It's an all hands on deck moment. And that means that we need a bipartisan approach to protecting our oceans and coasts in Florida, whether that means, you're going to get people from across the aisle in opposition to oil and gas drilling, or people from across the aisle in support of harmful algal bloom legislation. We're seeing Governor DeSantis coming out and vetoing a plastic straw ban on bans in the last session. So,
letting local communities pass their own ordinances on that.
Correct. And so we encourage that kind of bipartisan approach. And we do think that if you want to be a Floridian, if you're an environmentalist in Florida, politics don't matter.
Now, members of Congress from Florida have proposed legislation that would protect the ocean and the beaches from offshore drilling. And you have been heavily involved in that, close to that as well. Is that right?
Yeah, we've been involved in supporting that kind of legislation. And like I said, we definitely support continuing the moratorium that's in place, especially in the Gulf of Mexico and definitely in the South Atlantic as well.
Okay. And so tell me more then about how your organization, the Florida Conservation Ocean Conservancy, tries to move the needle on these issues. You testified on Capitol Hill, but that's not all you're doing.
Yeah, Ocean Conservancy is a nonprofit organization headquartered in Washington, D.C., and we have offices throughout the country. Our Florida office is based in St. Petersburg, Florida, which is where I'm located. I'm a sixth-generation Floridian, born and raised in Brevard County, just down the coast. Mm-hmm. And we've had an office, Ocean Conservancy's had an office in Florida for more than 30 years. And we've worked on coastal resiliency issues, fisheries, marine debris and plastics, harmful algal blooms, water quality and quantity, all of these issues that are so critically important to Florida. And we use science along with policy to effect meaningful change and positive solutions for the state, and not just Florida, but across the country and actually around the global ocean planet.
And the threats are greater than they've ever been. So how concerned are you about? You just gave a whole laundry list of all of the issues that you're dealing with, and they keep getting more intense.
I'm extremely concerned, but, and you know, as a Floridian, I love the coasts. I've got a 5-year-old daughter and a 3-year-old daughter, and we love to go to the beach, we love to snorkel, we love to swim, and we love to fish. And I want to be able to do that forever with them and with their children. And so when I look at, you know, sea level rise that I'm actually seeing on the coast in St. Petersburg or in Miami or on the east central coast of Florida, I'm frankly alarmed. And I feel like that's why it's such an all hands on deck moment. And that's why I'm here right now talking to you, because it's so necessary to get this message out for us all to work together to find solutions.
And certainly we feel the same way here, which is why we launched adaptflorida.org. Let me ask you, though, as a follow-up, at what point do living shorelines and other measures become ineffective? At what point do leaders in this state have to consider more drastic measures if the water keeps coming in, as it's expected to do?
I mean, I think that the time for forecasting those potential threats is now. I mean, I think you need to know you need to calculate what the risks are going to be early on. And I think that makes sense from an economic perspective, and it makes sense from a social perspective as well. But I don't think that it necessarily means you have to be doom and gloom and have to be planning for a mass exodus from the state. I think that there are on the water, on the ground things that we can be doing to restore these ecosystems and to actually protect ourselves from the threats that we're immediately facing.
So what's your message then to people listening about what they can do, particularly people that live on the water?
I think first and foremost, what you need to do is reach out to your regulators, reach out to your policymakers, and reach out to your elected officials. I think you need to call Tallahassee, you need to call Governor DeSantis, you need to call your folks in Washington, D.C., and tell them exactly how you feel. It matters. They need to hear from you, and they are listening.
Well, I know they were listening to you too today. So thank you for stopping by and sharing this with our listeners and making the drive over here. We so appreciate it.
I'm so glad to be here anytime.
And please come back. He's J.P. Brooker, Senior Manager, Policy Counsel for the Florida Conservation Ocean Conservancy. And up next, you're not going to want to miss this one. Deadheads Unite as a celebration of the life of Jerry Garcia is happening downtown this weekend. We'll tell you where and how you can be part of it right after this. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. We'll be right back.
Front page of today's Times Union.
At the top of the page, Florida lawmakers made...
Around the country, volunteers are reading local newspapers to people with vision loss or print disabilities. Did you know WJCT has this service? On a special radio we provide, you'll get the Florida Times Union every day. Learn more at wjct.org/radio reading. With help from sponsors like Florida Eye Specialists, Radio Reading gives voice to the printed word.
WJCT's Summer of Space invites you to experience the thrilling era of the space race all summer long. Enjoy special programming exploring our skies and taking you on a journey through the universe. Featured programs include a new space-themed antiques roadshow, Out of This World, and NOVA's Back to the Moon and the Planets. Visit wjct.org/summer of space to check out all other upcoming Summer of Space programs.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with New Yorker staff writer Gia Tolentino in her new collection of essays. She writes from the perspective of a millennial about feminism, social media, growing up in a Southern Baptist megachurch, why she left the church, and why she left the Peace Corps before her time was up. I hope you'll join us. Today at noon on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
After mass shootings over the weekend killed more than 30 people here in the U.S., other countries are trying to understand.
It's virtually impossible to explain to a New Zealander where gun culture in the U.S. comes from.
I'm Ari Shapiro, the international perspective on gun violence in America, plus the latest from El Paso and Dayton this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Experts say white supremacist domestic terrorism is likely to rise, but too often it's treated as a series of isolated incidents by lone wolf attackers. President Trump's critics say his words and actions fuel this violence. How should our leaders, including the president, stand up to hate and violence? Next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, finally this hour, it's a celebration of the life of Jerry Garcia. The 24th annual China Cat Sunflower Festival is taking over Riverside Arts Market this Saturday. Festival founder Brenda Walker is here to get us into the Grateful Dead vibe this morning. Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
The 24th annual festival, ever since Jerry Garcia passed, you've been holding this in Jacksonville mm-hmm. for a quarter of a century now, just about.
Mm-hmm.
What a legacy. So what all can we expect at RAM this weekend?
A lot of tie-dye.
Right.
A lot of wonderful music. And I've always done the festival pretty much money-free, not having much of a money trail. But doing it RAM, you know, the bands are going to get paid, which is really
which
nice.
Which is great.
Change.
So several bands performing, right?
Three. Ouija Brothers, Glass Camels, and Not Quite Dead. And then there'll be lots of others. Maddie Carr will be playing, and I'm doing a yoga class at the RAM from 9 to 10 that'll be Grateful Dead lyric inspired. And at the end of the class at 10 o'clock, we'll have a group sing of Ripple.
Nice.
Which will make you cry. Beautiful song.
This is such a cool thing to enjoy before everybody goes back to school. Mm-hmm. And let me ask you, why do you think the Dead's legacy has only deepened in the years since Garcia passed away?
Because the vibe is a kind vibe. It's about kindness. It really is. After my second show, I came home and my Buddhist review, a quarterly thing, was in my mailbox. And in that was a review, an interview with Jerry Garcia comparing the Dead philosophy of kindness to Buddhism.
Are you a Buddhist?
I am.
So that's what attracted you to
the
music and the
what
band?
Attracted me was I walked into my first show. I was 42 years old and everybody was dancing and singing every word to every song. And I was like, these are my people. Where have I been all my life? And I saw 28 shows in the next 3 years.
Did you follow the Dead?
I did. Every show I saw, almost every show, Bruce Hornsby was with them when they toured on this coast. I saw two shows with the Dead and Sting, two shows with the Dead and, or four actually altogether, with the Dead and Dylan. Yeah, it was, those 3.5 years were amazing. I met Jerry. I bought some of his artwork.
Uh-huh.
Best investment I ever made.
I bet. I bet it's appreciated mm-hmm. a lot. Mm-hmm. What do you think of this being replicated now with younger music fans who would follow Phish around in kind of the same way that people used to follow the Dead?
Yeah, it those jam band things are happening now. But what blows me away is one year at the festival, there was this girl. She couldn't have been more than 16. She couldn't have even been alive when Jerry died. She was dancing, spinning, wore the right dress so she could spin. And singing every word. Her mom and dad raised her right, I guess. But it's interesting to me that it is generational. Kids are still into it. I met a guy Sunday who'd never even seen them. And he was playing music. I was teaching yoga in Memorial Park in my class. And he, as soon as the class was over, started playing Grateful Dead music. He had a T-shirt on that said China Cat that he had had made. He'd never even seen the band.
All generations.
Yes.
Well, you want to quote something yes. Jerry Garcia once said.
Yes.
Let's hear it.
Someone asked him what they were all about, and he said, what we're thinking about is a peaceful planet. We're not thinking about anything else. We're not thinking about any kind of power struggle, revolution, war, or anything like that. That's not what we want. Nobody wants to get hurt. Nobody wants to hurt anybody. We would all like to live an uncluttered life, a simple life, a good life, and think about moving the whole human race ahead a step or a few steps.
Well, that just about sums it up. So come on out, meet Brenda and all the other fans of this vibe, as you put it, at the China Cat Sunflower Festival, the 24th annual, this Saturday at Riverside Arts Market. Enjoy the music, enjoy the fun, and make sure to wear your tie-dye, just like Brenda. And just for you, Brenda, and all of us older Deadhead fans, this song is for you as we close.
Thank you.
A Little Touch of Gray.
Oh, yeah.
And tomorrow, a conversation with Congressman Al Lawson. Listen in for that tomorrow at 9. I'm Melissa Ross. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.